for the great honor of giving this public lecture today. I know there was this conference is bringing some of the leading cardiologists and physicists, mathematicians, biomedical engineers interested in finding solutions to reduce mortality from fibrillation. There was a broad choice of speakers, so you know, I feel very honored. And also, I also looked at the list of previous speakers who gave public lectures in the KITP series. And so, the workshop that I'm co-organizing with some colleagues is bringing together a fairly interdisciplinary group of people that from physics community, mathematics, biomedical engineering, also cardiology, to try to find a basic understanding of one of the leading causes of death, which is cardiac fibrillation. And my goal today is to sort of give you an introduction to this topic, and also to, as part of this talk, to also give you some glimpse of the activity that has been taking place during this workshop, and new insights that are coming sort of every month, every day on this topic. So this is here a cross-section of the human heart. And let's first talk about normal function. These are the two atria and the two ventricles. The left ventricle is the main pump, which pumps fresh oxygenated blood into the entire body. The electrical activity originates in the sinoatrial node in the right atrium. This is the natural pacemaker of the heart that sends a fairly periodic signal and makes the two atria contract. There is then a slow conduction through this atrioventricular node to provide a propagation delay so the two atria can contract before the ventricles. Then this excitation, electrical excitation, propagates very quickly through the Purkinje fiber and causes a synchronous contraction of the ventricle, which is then pumping blood and maintaining us alive. So in a normal, you know, course of a lifetime, this contraction happens about 2 billion, so about 2 billion heartbeats in a lifetime. This is a, we're cut off a little bit here, but this is a typical electrocardiogram of a patient with a sudden episode of ventricular fibrillation. And what you see here is a normal sinus rhythm that I just described, where the electrical activity is being generated by the pacemaker of the heart and propagates in a rectilinear manner through the ventricle and causes a synchronous contraction. Then there is this transition from normal sinus rhythm to what is called ventricular tachycardia. And a ventricular tachycardia is a fast rhythm. If you look here, typical beat-to-beat interval of a second. Now this is maybe a third of a second or half a second, a much faster rhythm, where the ventricles are still contracting, are still pumping blood, but this rhythm is quite dangerous because it's a precursor to then a more chaotic rhythm, which is ventricular fibrillation. And during ventricular fibrillation, the heart stops pumping blood, and lack of oxygen to the brain causes sudden death. So there are sort of two interesting transitions. First, how does the heart make the transition from normal sinus rhythm to ventricular tachycardia? And then how does ventricular tachycardia degenerate into this chaotic rhythm, which is ventricular fibrillation? So I'll show you first a movie, which is the authors here, this is are cut off from the top, but it's a movie done by Eberhard Bodenschatz, who's one of my co-organizers, done work with Robert Gilmore in collaboration with Cornell Group. And this is here just a right ventricle of a dog, which is being imaged, and I'll tell you a little more about what is being imaged. But if you look at the wave activity during ventricular fibrillation, you see these very chaotic waves. So, you know, first question when you look at this picture is, what kind of waves are we talking about, and what is the reason for this turbulence? Oh, I see. Everything is being cut off from the top. I wonder if there's any way to make the image smaller. If not, I'll just... Okay, so what is the impact on human health? If you can fix it, it's fine. If not, it's not a problem. So cardiovascular disease is the single most common cause of death. Over half of the mortality is attributed to sudden cardiac death. That's, as David already said, is about 300,000 sudden cardiac deaths in the U.S. alone per year. And sudden cardiac death is the first symptomatic manifestation of heart disease in half of the victims, so it's the first and last manifestation. And over 80% of sudden cardiac deaths are associated with coronary artery disease and with the development of ventricular fibrillation. And a typical triggering event is a piece of plaque that detaches from coronary arteries and blocks coronary arteries, and then that triggers a cascade of events that leads to ventricular fibrillation. So the early observations of ventricular fibrillation date back to Andreas Vesalius in the Neumanni Corporis Fabrica in 1543, refers to worm-like movements before death in the heart of animals. So they were just observations from looking at the heart of animals. Vulpian appears to have been the first to describe this as mouvement fibrillaire in an article published in 1874. It was said during the conference that if you think that you've invented something in physiology, that means that you don't read German, because so nothing new is under the sun, but something is to be said also for the French literature. So, note sur les effets de la faradisation direct sur les ventricules du cœur de chien. So these were people who were looking at, you could induce fibrillation by having actually alternating electric current that could induce fibrillation. So this is in 1874. And this is before, of course, not too much was known about the electrical activity of the heart. Then with the development of the electrocardiogram by William Antoven, in the later part of the 19th century, Dutch physiologist. He refines the electrocardiogram of Wallers. And this is the first glimpse at the electrical activity of the heart. And this is a nice picture. Now when you go to your cardiologist, you have all these 12 lead electrocardiograms with these nice electrodes that make contact. And it's nice to see what our fathers went through to make electrical contact. So yes, actually, his hands are bathing salty solution here. And this is the basic electrocardiogram with three leads. So the electrocardiogram only gives you a global recording of the electrical activity of the heart and really doesn't give you direct insight into the wave turbulence. It's only looking at the tip of the iceberg. So this is going to be the next few slides, a crash course in cardiac electrophysiology, because I have to tell you about waves. And when we're thinking about waves, you go to the beach, you see the nice water waves, or you may have learned in school that light is, that electromagnetic radiation is being carried by waves. When you hear a guitar, a violin, you think about a wave which is vibrating. So when we talk about wave turbulence or waves propagating in the heart, what kind of waves are we talking about? So it is just a little bit of background. So this is here a schematic of a cardiac cell. So the heart is made of cells, and the cells are like a house. They have a wall that separates the inside from the outside of the cell. And the inside and outside the cell, the rest is mainly water and protein. So this is a lipid bilayer, which is making this wall. So here's a cell membrane. And embedded in this membrane are what are called ion channels, and which are, you can think of these as molecular switches. And they have the property, if we just now focus on the cell membrane, so the wall that separates the inside and outside, and there are different ions, which are here is sodium plus, so it has a charge plus, and these little molecular switches have selective permeabilities to different ion species. So when this little gate is closed, then the sodium, which has a higher concentration outside the cell, cannot pass through the cell. But in response to a small change of voltage, these little switches open, so it's a very highly nonlinear response, and the nonlinear aspect of the waves in the heart come from the fact that these molecular switches make abrupt responses. So they will like the flow of ions, sodium and potassium, and then the other important ion is calcium. So the electrical activity of the heart is being generated by the passage of these three ions through the cell membrane, and there is a tremendous complexity having to do with the fact that there are many, many of these molecular switches. And what the quantity of interest is the voltage difference between the outside and the inside of the cell. Every time that, so a very simple analog of this is when you take a flash with a camera. Before the flash goes on, there is a capacitor, and the cell is acting very much as a capacitor that charges. So there is a voltage across the capacitor, and then when you press on the button, then the capacitor discharges and you get a flash. So you can think that, you know, in terms of fundamental physics, what governs electrical activity of the heart is very much like a camera. It's a capacitor that charges, and then the discharge through these molecular switches is what generates a voltage impulse. So in the resting state of the membrane, there is, this is here in millivolts, this is the voltage, and when the waves are not propagating, the resting state of the membrane is at minus 80 millivolts. The passage of sodium causes the membrane to depolarize, and then there is a plateau duration during which the potassium and calcium currents balance each other, so the voltage is not changing because there is no net current. And then finally, the potassium current is responsible for the voltage coming back. So during one normal heartbeat, this, you can think very much like a flash of a camera, the charges for the sodium flow through the membrane causes a rapid depolarization, then the balance of these two currents gives you a plateau duration of the action potential, and this repolarizes. So this is the cardiac action potential, and this molecular circuitry was first the basic mechanisms were worked out half a century ago by Hodgkin and Oxley, who got Nobel Prize for this work. And we are now half a century of electrophysiology, and that has, you know, worked out many of the details of this molecular circuitry. So a very important quantity here is the duration of what is called this action potential, which is basically the duration of this electrical excitation of the heart. And so this parameter turns out to be the duration of the flash turns out to be an important quantity. And so I will illustrate this with the movie is not showing. I see. Oh, you have it. Okay. So this is when we talk about the early observation, I wanted to show. I apologize for the after dinner movie here, but this is actually the hand of my former graduate student, Flavio Fenton, who started his career as a high energy theorist, but didn't know what to expect, where this would lead him, a career in physics. But this is basically a view of fibrillation, very much as the early observations that would have taken place in the 19th century, where you see this desynchronized contraction, and so the heart is just quivering and not contracting. Another thing that I want to show you is a little animation, and you can go to the website which is indicated here, which is very nice in terms of a tutorial for getting intuition into the waves, the properties of the waves that propagate in the heart. So what we're going to see here along this axis is this transmembrane potential, this voltage pulse. And along here is actually a one-dimensional cable of cardiac tissue. And so the first property that I want to illustrate is that the heart is an excitable medium. So if you go here and just inject a little current which causes the voltage to rise to a certain value, and you just stop that current, this little pulse just dies. Now, if you inject a little more current, still nothing happened. Okay, and if you raise it a little harder, then you get two pulses. Okay, so an excitable medium, by definition, is a system which, if you give it a small perturbation, the small perturbation just relaxes and dies out, But if the perturbation of the system is larger than some threshold, then you get a large response, which in this case is this cardiac action potential. So that's one first important property. The other property is this refractory period or duration of the action potential. And let's look at this. So let's trigger a pulse. And let's try to excite the tissue during this pulse. And as you can conclude from this, during this, as this wave is propagated, you try to excite the tissue, you cannot trigger another excitation. So the tissue is refractory during this period. So the wave is propagating. If I try to excite it here, right, I cannot trigger another wave. So one way to think about this, a nice analogy, is a forest fire. So if you have a forest, you can think of this as just, there would be trees here, and if you light a fire in the middle, if the fire is too small, it won't catch, the forest won't catch on fire, so it's excitable in that sense. But if the fire is large enough, the fire will spread and will burn the forest. Well, while the trees are burned, if you try to relight a fire, you cannot relight a fire until the trees have grown again. And when the trees have grown again, then you can light a fire again. So this duration during which the trees have to regrow so you can light a fire for another fire to propagate is the refractory period of the excitable medium. And let me illustrate it one more time here. You try to excite during this refractory period where the tree haven't regrown, and once the tree have regrown, you can generate another wave. Okay. So another important property of these waves is when two waves collide, they annihilate, which is very different than, you know, the waves that you're used to. When you throw a stone in a pond, you get waves that just propagate, and if you throw another stone at a different place, the waves come and actually they interfere. Right? So you can get constructive and destructive interferences. These waves don't add or subtract. When they collide, they actually annihilate, more like particles in some areas of physics. So let's generate a wave on the left-hand side here, and let's generate one on the right-hand side. When they collide, the two waves annihilate each other. So these few concepts are going to be important for then explaining some of the mechanisms. So the propagation okay. Let's see what's happening here. There it goes. So we saw that the waves propagated. The way the propagation takes place is that the cells are actually connected, and that ions that I just showed you in the previous slides can actually pass from one cell to the other. So when the camera flash goes on in one cell and triggers the excitation, some of the ions flow to the other cell and then cause a discharge of this cell, which then causes the wave to propagate. So when we look at this action potential, then as a function of position, and here is time, this wave just propagates at a velocity which is on the order of 0.5 meters per second. So you can say, well, you have an electrical signal. What good is this electrical signal for? Because in the end, the heart wants to contract, and contraction is a mechanical signal. So the main goal of the voltage of this electrical pulse is actually to cause calcium to enter the cell. So this is, again, the cell membrane that I showed you earlier. And when calcium enters the cell, it triggers calcium, which is stored, intracellular stored, to be released. So if you look at the calcium concentration inside the cell, the number of calcium ions in this volume, it rises. This is the blue curve. And then calcium in turn binds to some myofilaments and causes the cell to contract. So you have a cascade of three coupled signal, a voltage pulse which propagates, causes calcium to rise in the cell, and then calcium in turn causes a mechanical signal, which is a contraction of the heart. So something to appreciate, and one of the challenges in this field, is if we think about the molecular processes which are happening on the time scale and line scale of ion channel, So shown here is the time in seconds, and here our length scale. So on the sort of picosecond time scale, you have the thermal agitation, which causes this, which controls the kinetics of these ion channels. Then as you go to a whole cell, you have an assembly of all these molecular switches. A typical cell is on the size of 100 microns. And then finally, when you go to tissue here, you have many cells which are coupled. There are about 10 to the 5 of these molecular switches per cell. And then once you go to the whole heart, you have about 1 billion cells. So one of the challenges is to be able to relate the properties of the ion channels to the behavior and the arrhythmias that take place at the level of the entire organ. So there's been a lot of progress in imaging the electrical activity of the heart since Antoven, and shown here are the typical experiments that people in this workshop are doing to gain insight experimentally into mechanisms of arrhythmias. So this is a typical experiment where you have the heart of a guinea pig. These animal experiments, the heart is being pressed against a glass plate, and then cameras are being used, to CCD cameras, to image the both the electrical signal that I showed you and also the calcium signal. And so this is now, for the resolution has been going up every year, but a typical image gives you a 16 by 16 array, and you can see both the voltage and the calcium signal. So this is a lot of data and a lot more information than the electrocardiogram, which only gives you a global measure of the electrical activity of the heart. Here you can measure the electrical activity locally in each point on the heart, and also the calcium activity. So what are the mechanisms of ventricular tachycardia and the conceptualization of ventricular fibrillation in the context that people have been thinking about these questions historically? So very important and pioneering work in this field is the work of Mines. And Mines conducted experiments where he looked at the propagation of electrical excitation. And he was the first one to demonstrate that the waves that I showed you in this little tutorial can actually propagate around an obstacle. So this is some region of the heart which is not excitable, where the wave cannot propagate. This obstacle occur naturally in the heart and are certainly also, after myocardial infarction, part of the heart becomes necrotic and can also provide one of these obstacles. So the waves, these electrical waves can circulate. And if we think about anatomical, this is called anatomical reentry. And the term reentry describes the fact that a wave can reenter the same region and tissue, while in the normal function of the heart, a wave does not re-enter the same region of tissue. It only propagates in a rectilinear manner and only visits each region of tissue once in each heartbeat, while here the wave re-enters repeatedly. So if we think about the frequency of this wave, we can get some idea. A typical propagation velocity of a wave, if we take 0.25 meters per second or 25 centimeters per second, and if we divide by the perimeter of the ring, which is of a typical obstacle of 5 centimeters, we get a frequency of rotation of this wave of about 5 hertz. So this frequency is a much higher frequency than the normal beating of the heart. Now remember what I showed you in the tutorial is when two waves encounter each other, they annihilate. So anytime that you create a higher frequency source in the heart, and this source is starting to produce waves, then it takes over the function of the heart and now becomes, instead of the natural pacemaker, becomes the source of waves. And the heart cannot sustain such a typical high frequency of contraction. Gary, in 1914, suggested that actually this reentry or this circulation of waves of electrical activity could actually take place without an anatomical obstacle. But at the time, this theory was disregarded and was judged that it was not sufficient evidence to prove the theory that you could have a wave that would circulate in tissue without an obstacle. If you think about it, it's much more natural to think about a merry-go-round of a wave circulating around an obstacle. If there is no obstacle in the center, then you say, okay, it's circulating, but then what's happening in the center? So this is here a movie from the group in McGill, just showing you in a tissue culture the circulation here that had been postulated by Mines as a mechanism of reentry. Now these electrical waves can be studied in tissue culture, and you see this nice reentry. For the functional reentry, it's a very interesting crossroad of cardiology and the field of nonlinear dynamics of studies of reaction waves. And one of the pioneers in this is Art Winfrey, late Art Winfrey, who died of a brain tumor in 2002. Another important pioneer is Valentin Krinsky in Russia, who has trained many of the active young people in this field. It was actually part of our workshop. So there is a interesting chemical reaction. So we're saying, what does a chemical reaction have to do with the heart? Well, these chemical systems turns out to have excitable properties and to have waves with a very similar property as cardiac waves. So this chemical reaction was discovered by Belousov and then more developed by his colleague Zabotinsky. And because of based on the analogy between the excitable property of the chemical reaction and the excitable properties of the heart, it was postulated that spiral waves should actually exist in the heart. And the definition, the difference between spiral waves and anatomical reentry is that these waves can rotate in free space without any anatomical obstacle. So in fact, the conjecture of Gary of 1914 were reborn in the form of spiral waves. The first observation of spiral waves in cardiac tissue comes in 1992 when Khalifi and co-workers first demonstrated the existence in sheep heart. This is a cover of Physics Today showing that spiral waves and excitable media are actually, these waves are observed in a wide range of system. And now to go to a completely different system, what I'm going to show you is signaling in a colony of amoeba colonies. So what you're seeing here is some little organisms so that live independently, but when food gets depleted, they actually signal and send some waves of cyclic AMP, which is a signaling agent which signals the aggregation of these small organisms. And if you see here, there is also spirals that form. So what this movie shows is that there is great cross-fertilization of the studies of the waves in very diverse excitable media that range from chemical reaction to aggregating amoebas. And what you're seeing here on the left is actually the cell motion, and as a response to these waves are actually aggregating. So in this context, this sort of wave activity is actually being utilized by the survival of this organism. This is now in a cardiac tissue culture. One of our participants here, a new method to image these waves. So this is now a cardiac tissue culture, and you're seeing two spiral waves here which are rotated. This is actually now in actual cardiac tissue. I'll show you a movie. This is again a cardiac tissue culture, another of our participants, Emilian Sheva, where you see this nice spiral wave of electrical activity in the heart. Actually, what's being imaged here is the calcium activity. And as the wave meanders around, it traces these very nice flower patterns, which are the same type of meandering trajectories that were also seen in the chemical reaction. So this shows a sort of universality of some of the properties of these waves, that whether you look at the heart, whether you look at dictyostelium, this aggregating amoeba colonies, or whether you look at chemical reaction, you have some similar behavior. So going back to the original slide I showed you on the electrocardiogram, we now have a way of conceptualizing fibrillation. In the normal sinus rhythm, and this is shown here in tissue culture, in the normal sinus rhythm, you have a pacemaker that just paces wave, that just propagates and causes the contraction of the heart. Then for some reason, this sinus rhythm is interrupted and there is a transition to ventricular tachycardia, which are these spiral waves of electrical activity that rotates at much higher frequency. And then there's yet another transition where these waves becomes even more disorganized and these one or two spiral waves and the wave further wave breaks causes this then collection of wandering wavelets, which is believed to be the underlying mechanism of fibrillation. So in terms of the thing that you'd like to understand is what is the cause for the transition from normal sinus rhythm to ventricular tachycardia, and then from ventricular tachycardia to fibrillation, with now this conceptualization of these arrhythmias in terms of these waves. The other thing that I want to now show you is the original movie that I showed you of the wave turbulence. So when you look at this movie, you really don't know, you know, what is really the cause of this turbulence. So this is recent work of one of our co-organizers, Eberhard Bodenschatz in the Cornell group. But now when you look and actually image this with the idea that you should be looking for spiral waves, and you look actually at the phase of these waves, then you get this actually turbulent but highly organized electrical activity where the main motor of the fibrillation, every one of these points is actually showing the tip of a spiral, and you can see that these spirals are being created and annihilated, and there is the underlying mechanism of this turbulence is actually this dance, this complex dance of these spirals. So this is all nice. Spiral waves get created. They cause the heart to contract hard, to contract too fast, and then to have, in fact, stop pumping blood and then cause the sudden death. So how do we go from normal sinus rhythm to ventricular tachycardia? So one important element for understanding this transition are triggers, or actually lethal triggers. So what is shown here is the electrocardiogram of someone in the intensive care units and showing actually the sort of sequence of events before an episode of ventricular tachycardia. And what you see is you have the normal electrocardiogram, and once in a while you get what is called a premature ventricular contraction. One area of the heart becomes temporarily a pacemaker and sends the waves that will then interfere with the main wave, which is coming from the natural pacemaker of the heart. So you have one premature ventricular contraction here, another one there, and so on. And in a healthy heart, premature ventricular contraction are actually not lethal, but the combination of premature ventricular contraction and an heterogeneous substrate that I will describe can actually provide the mechanism for transition to fibrillation. So why are triggers bad? This is now an example from German Shepherd dogs that have inherited abnormalities that tend them to have arrhythmias. And what you see is a lot of these ectopic activity, which is this premature ventricular contraction, and then this transient episode of sudden ventricular tachycardia, and many of these dogs actually die prematurely. But they provide an interesting example in which to study those mechanisms. So I'm going to show some movie to illustrate the role of triggers. So first, just to as a prelude to what you're going to be seeing, we're going to be seeing some movies that show you the response of the heart to this premature ventricular contraction. So this is the action potential that I showed you earlier that is propagating across the heart like the discharge of a flash. And this black region is excitable tissue. This is would be like the forest where the trees are grown. This is like the burned forest. The waves is propagating, then the trees regrow, and then the next waves can come back. Okay. So we're going to be seeing what happens when we have the combination of a plane wave, which is a type of waves that you would be getting through from the normal sinoid train load, the normal pacemaker of the heart, and what happens when you have a trigger. So this is here in case A. What you're going to see is a first wave is being triggered from this side, and you can think of this as an idealization, but conceptually gives you insight in what a premature ventricular contraction does. So this would be, you can think of this as the normal pacemaker of the heart, which is sending a plane wave, which is going to cause the heart to contract. And then right here in the center, there's going to be a premature ventricular contraction, which is some area in the heart, instead of being excitable, is going to send a premature trigger. And so what you saw here is that in this case, nothing happened. So if you remember what I showed you earlier in the movie, is for a wave to propagate, the tissue has to be excitable. After the passage of a previous wave, the tissue is still refractory, so if you have a premature ventricular contraction, then actually nothing happens. So shown on this graph here is the intensity of this actually second stimulus, and shown on this axis is the time difference between when the first stimulus was triggered and when the second stimulus was triggered. And so to the left of this curve, the tissue is refractory, so there cannot be an excitation, which is what we saw here. Now let's look at case C, where the premature ventricular contraction comes in after the passage of the wave. Then you get just an extra wave, and this is what's called an extra systole. And this is not in itself arrhythmic, it just gives you one extra heartbeat. So this is here case C, where there's been sufficient time between the first wave and the second wave, and this just gives you an extra systole. Then the case which is interesting is case B, where actually the second stimulus is going to come at a time interval where the tissue is still refractory on one side, so the wave cannot propagate to the right, but actually is excitable on the left, where there has been more time for the tissue to recover its excitability. So what happens here in case B? Premature contraction, and now generation, spontaneous generation of two spiral waves, just from a single premature ventricular contraction. Let's look at this movie again, because it's quite important. What happened? Let's stop it. Oops, not cooperating. Okay, let's see if we can try one more time. Okay. Doesn't seem to be cooperating. But I think what you see is that now you have this premature ventricular contraction. It tries to propagate to the right. The tissue is refractory. Here it's excitable, so it backpropagates and creates spontaneously a pair of counter-rotating spiral waves. Although I've illustrated this with computer simulations, this has been done experimentally, and this mechanism is well established. Then you can ask, why don't we all drop dead? Because actually, if you put a Holter monitor on most people, even young, healthy people, they will have PVCs once in a while. Well, what's happening is that the thing that I've been told is that in normal heart, the stimulus, the intensity of the second stimulus is very high. So this vulnerable window where the second stimulus can trigger these reentrant waves, we can then generate into fibrillation, is actually 100 times larger than the normal strength of the stimulus of a PVC. So really, the big question is, what causes this vulnerable window to actually move down into a regime where actually a normal PVC, just a very small intensity stimulus, is enough to trigger these spiral waves? So this is the basic now idea where we're going, is what causes this vulnerable window to go down. So the idea is that a trigger by itself with a healthy heart is not enough to precipitate the heart into fibrillation. However, if there is a combination of a trigger and a disordered substrate, so a heart which is heterogeneous, so the electrical properties of the heart becomes heterogeneous, then the combination of the two is enough to trigger ventricular tachycardia and then degeneration to fibrillation. So arrhythmogenic substrate for reentry and fibrillation result from static heterogeneities of electrical properties associated with various disease. So the predominant view in the cardiology literature has been that if there are heterogeneities, they are in fact fixed and are the result of disease. So this is the mechanisms of unidirectional block that was actually introduced by Mines in 1913. I already spoke earlier that Mines demonstrated the circulation of electrical impulse, but he did more than this. He actually also hypothesized the mechanisms and demonstrated experimentally a mechanism for how you induce this reentrant excitation. And it's the following. So imagine you have the premature stimulus that I just showed you in the earlier movies, and imagine that this piece of cardiac tissue is now heterogeneous. So the left region here has a longer refractory period. So in fact, if you think of the forest fire analogy, when the fire spreads here after a previous fire, it took longer time for the trees to regrow here than there. So when the wave comes, it actually blocks. It cannot propagate. So what it will do, it will propagate around, but by the time it comes back here, now the tissue is again excitable, and then you get now a creation of this reentrant circuit. So the basic point is of this mechanism is that if you have heterogeneities of electrical properties, that provides a mechanism for unidirectional block. A wave comes, blocks on one side, but by the time it comes back, this is again excitable and you get the circulation. This is actually from Mind's paper, the mechanism of atomical reentry. Shown here is case A, where actually you have a premature beat that sends two waves, one to the right, one to the left, and everything, the whole tissue is depolarized, and then after that the waves annihilate and there is nothing. But here is the case where you have unidirectional block. The wave does not propagate on the left, and then it propagates on the right, and after that this wave is maintained. So this is from the original drawing of the 1913 paper. Let me illustrate this with a computer simulation. So what you're going to see here is again a wave. This would be like the normal pacemaker of the heart, and this wave is going to propagate across the heart. And you have an atomical obstacle. So the only difference here, this is a piece of cardiac tissue, but this little region here of the tissue, the refractory period is a little bit longer. And you can see here the voltage trace on the lower part here of the tissue gives you this little bump because you have actually a longer refractory period. Now this is the second stimulus. The second stimulus is going to come, and because of this longer refractory period, what you're going to see is that the wave is going to block here. But then it's going to actually propagate around, and by the time that the wave comes back, now this is again excitable and it's going to propagate. So let's look at that. Blocks at the bottom, recirculates above, and now we have this reentrant circuit which is created. A lot of arrhythmias of people who have already had myocardial infarction, and actually people that walk with ventricular tachycardia into hospital usually have a large enough infarct that this wave which is circulating around is at a frequency that is not too high so that there is no hemodynamic collapse and that the patient can actually make it to hospital. A large activity, which is catheter ablation, and we have, you know, Bill Stevenson from Brigham and Women's is one of the experts in this area. It's Johnny's conference, is to actually identify the narrowest pathway of the circulating activity to come with a catheter which uses radio frequency to burn tissue and actually to just burn a piece of tissue so that the narrowest pathway, the wave cannot propagate, and then the reentrant circuit is terminated. If you look, so although this movie looks dynamic that I just showed you, think about what is really arrhythmogenic. What is really arrhythmogenic is shown here is actually this refractory period. This is the duration of the camera flash or the cardiac excitation. And if you see the wave propagated, but the only thing that triggered this arrhythmia is the fact that this piece of tissue had a longer refractory period. That's shown here in red. This is in milliseconds. So here the duration is longer. But if you look at this picture, this is a completely static picture. Right? The substrate here is static, and this could be caused by various disease causes the heart to become heterogeneous, and I won't go into all the details that can cause an atypical substrate. There's been a growing recognition starting from work that was done in about 20 years ago and increasing work in the last decade, that actually these heterogeneities can be dynamically produced. So arrhythmogenic substrate for reentry and fibrillation result from dynamic instabilities, wave instability at a cellular level that create new or enhanced pre-existing static heterogeneities on the tissue scale. So this is really a new conceptualization of looking at the mechanisms of fibrillation, which has come from a lot of the work that physicists have done in collaboration with biologists and cardiologists. So what I'm going to show you now in what follows is some insights of how can you create, instead of creating this substrate from just saying that this piece of tissue is different because of some disease, how can this heterogeneity occur dynamically? So this is here a picture of Ludwig Traub, who was the first one to observe a phenomena which is well known in nonlinear dynamics, which is period doubling. The fact that when you have a phenomenon which is rhythmical, it actually takes 2 beats to repeat the same patterns. So for those of you who play music, it would be, you know, it would take every other beat to repeat. So do, re, do, re. And this is actually Pilz's alternance, which is just the strength of the pulse of a patient. And a very pioneering work by Nolasco and Dallin in 1968, they provided a mechanistic understanding of this alternance in a different context. This is now this action potential that I showed you. And you're seeing here every pulse corresponds to one heartbeat. And what you're seeing is that the pulse actually duration, this refractory period, is now oscillating from beat to beat in this period doubling fashion. Right? So it takes 2 beats to repeat the same patterns. That's why it's called period doubling, because the period, instead of being one, is now takes 2 beats to repeat the same patterns. So this is purely in time. And another reason why these alternates have been of interest is that in the T wave, so now at the level of the electrocardiogram, at the level of the whole heart, what has been first noticed empirically is that if the T wave portion of the electrocardiogram oscillates from beat to beat, and this is a very small oscillation, typical magnitude of the T wave is on the of the electrocardiogram is on the order of the millivolt, and here you're looking at a beat-to-beat oscillation on the order of a microvolt. Okay, so one part in 100. But if a patient patients have a sufficiently large amplitude of T wave alternance, then that puts them at risk of arrhythmia. And shown here is an older graph of a comparison of the survival of the survival of a group of patients that have tested positive of this T-wave alternance test, and see that those that tested positive actually die at a faster rate than those that tested negative. And for a benchmark, this is compared to a standard EP test. And there's been more clinical trials since then, and a lot more data accumulated on this T-wave alternance that was presented also today at the meeting. So mounting evidence that this beat-to-beat alternation is causally related to sudden death. The other thing that Nolasco and Dallin did in this really pioneering work in the 60s is to provide a mechanism for explaining the reason of this alternance. And what they did is they plotted the duration of the cardiac electrical impulse as a function of the interval between two waves, which is plotted here. And this curve actually can become steep. And there is a reason for this, is that there has to be sufficient time for the heart to actually, during this period, the heart expands and fills with blood. So as you start to exercise and then the heart rate increases, then the duration of electrical excitation and this interval have to actually go down in a proportionate way so that there is sufficient time for diastolic filling. If this curve is steep, however, you can see in the flat portion of this curve, which is during a normal heartbeat, actually at the normal heart rate, then a change of this interval causes only a small change of the excitation. But actually at a smaller, faster heart rate, a smaller period, then a small change of this interval gets actually magnified and give you a larger change of the duration of the pulse. And then this amplifies from beat to beat, and a steep restitution is actually the cause for this alternance. So it's the amplification mechanism that comes from the steepness of this curve. When I did some work about now over 10 years ago of trying to understand mechanism of fibrillation, it seemed to me that it was a good idea to look at the consequences of this restitution property in a tissue. So what I'm going to show you is a movie that shows, that compares the response to premature trigger for a case where the slope of the restitution curve is actually flat, so that the tissue doesn't have this electrical alternance, and what you induce from a premature ventricular contraction is just the spiral waves. However, if this restitution property is steep, and at the pacing frequency of the spiral waves, you get this alternate response, this period doubling, then this provides the mechanisms for the wave to break and for a transition to this turbulence, which is a basic conceptualization of fibrillation. What's important in this view of looking at fibrillation is that all the cells in this tissue are homogeneous. So main conclusion of this work is that actually it is not necessary to invoke anatomical heterogeneities to, at least in a computer simulation, understand fibrillation. Fibrillation can occur in homogeneous tissue also. A theory is not worth much unless there's some experimental test, and even when it's tested, one can, especially in a biological context, one can also argue about the interpretation of the experiments. But there was a very nice experiment that was done by my UCLA collaborators where they basically induced fibrillation with a premature stimulus in a heart, and with drug intervention, they were able to flatten the slope of the restitution. So this is the control. When you, during control, you actually get induced ventricular fibrillation, and you have a steep restitution curve. And when you add two drugs, beryllium and chromacolin, the effect of these is actually to give you a flat restitution curve, which do not produce these beat-to-beat alternations. And in this case, the heart could only induce ventricular tachycardia, which is a single reentrant spiral wave, which does not degenerate into fibrillation. And what's really remarkable is when you actually add this drug, you can actually revert back ventricular fibrillation to ventricular tachycardia. Whether the mechanism described in the simulation is really what's happening in the experiment, it's still very much controversial because the experiment is much more complicated. But at least this opens the possibility that by the pharmacological intervention, it may be possible to actually prevent ventricular fibrillation. Now you can say, why aren't these drugs miracle drugs? Well, they are calcium channel blockers, so you don't have fibrillation, but then the heart doesn't contract. But at least it opens the possibility that one may be able to find drugs that change, alter the dynamics so as to prevent fibrillation, but still maintain the normal contraction of the heart. And this is actually one of the main goals of some collaborative work that is being led by Jim Weiss, funded by the NIH, to find some ways to modify the single cell dynamics so as to have this stabilizing property, but still maintaining contraction. Another interesting phenomena related to dynamic heterogeneity has to do with the initiation of ventricular tachycardia. What I just showed you is evidence that dynamics plays a role in the transition from tachycardia to fibrillation. Let's not just step back and look at the role of dynamics in just the induction of ventricular tachycardia in the first place. So an important observation that comes from a very nice work of David Rosenbaum, this is now a guinea pig heart, and the electrical activity is being mapped optically. And what they notice is that two regions of the heart can start to alternate out of phase. So you have this beat-to-beat alternation of the action potential duration. This top region of the heart, it's long, and then the next beat, it's short. But in this region of the heart, it's actually short and then long. So it is a dephasing of this oscillation. Now let's think what's going to happen. On the same beat, one region is going to be long, and the other region is going to be short. So we now have a spatial heterogeneity on a given beat, but that has been actually produced dynamically by this dephasing. So the same mechanism of minds that induces reentry can now come from this desynchronization of these oscillations. This is shown here to contrast a spatially concordant alternance where the whole heart oscillates in phase from beat to beat with discordant alternance where actually two regions oscillate out of phase as I show in this experiment. And the consequence of this is that if we have a premature trigger, just like in the unidirectional block mechanisms postulated by Mines, then in the presence of discordant alternance, this trigger is going to actually block here because it is going to encounter refractory tissue and it can then recirculate around, and then you have now the induction of ventricular tachycardia. So dynamics can also play a role in the initiation, the transition from normal sinus rhythm to tachycardia. This is just some illustration where ideas of physics, and I will talk a little bit about fundamental physics, can lead some insight. So this phenomenon of discordant alternance, its arrhythmogenic role was demonstrated experimentally, and then a question that came up is, what is the mechanism for this desynchronization? Is it spontaneous, or is there actually, because if we can understand this desynchronization, then maybe we can prevent it. So the first thing we did is, in the original paper by David Rosenbaum, it was postulated that actually these two regions of tissue are out of phase because the properties of these regions of tissue are different. So being physicists, we thought, well, why don't we paste a piece of cardiac tissue where all the cells are identical? And what we found is when we place them in a region of alternance, we could spontaneously generate this discordant pattern of alternance in completely homogeneous tissue. Furthermore, we looked at this in a one-dimensional table, and what we realized is actually this desynchronization is actually the manifestation of a wave phenomena in the formation of a periodic patterns. And concepts of broken symmetry, which have been very useful for understanding the formation of patterns in non-equilibrium system, in this case what is being broken is a translation symmetry along the cable, turn out to be important for understanding the genesis of these patterns, and moreover for identifying some basic properties of cardiac tissue and some fundamental length scale, which then determines the spacing between these nodes that separate out of phase region. And certainly one can think of using this understanding to try to control these patterns and suppress them, or by various either pharmacological ways or using low amplitude stimuli. Strings. So, you know, strings come in many different length scales and many different contexts in physics. I think with global warming, we're going to see more and more of these strings. I don't need to explain what this is. Let's see, in Santa Barbara, that's right, we're not in the Midwest. But I'm sure some of you may have relatives or at least encountered this. So everything I've shown you, that there hasn't been any strings. There's been vortices, and everything has been very one-dimensional or two-dimensional. Actually, the heart is quite a thick muscle. It's about 1 or 2 centimeters in thickness. It also has a very interesting architecture, because the cells, the cardiac cells, are about 100 micron long by about 10 microns. So they're sort of like elongated bricks, and you have this brick layer that makes this tissue. And then this fiber axis, as you go from the inside wall of the heart to the outside wall, actually rotates, and it rotates by an angle of almost pi. And this rotation is actually there for mechanical reason. Okay, so this sort of a nested fiber architecture is responsible for an efficient mechanical contraction of the heart. But then the question is, what happens to these vortices? What happens to these spiral waves when one has this sick tissue? So shown here are movies of vortices. And shown here is what happens with decreasing excitability of the tissue. So for normal excitability or high excitability, spiral waves sort of meanders along this path. And then as you lower excitability, they trace these flower patterns that I showed you earlier in the chemical reactions, and also in the tissue culture of Emilia. And then finally, as you lower enough excitability, then you get this rigid rotation around the small center. Now, when you go in three dimension, these spiral waves become vortex filaments, because they now have to wrap up around the central region. And what is shown here, actually, is that the spiral is rotating around this central region, but this is actually a snapshot at one time. So now there are actually two fundamental properties of the filament. One is the tension. So if you think of a string normally has tension. And one of the properties is that this tension can actually become negative. And so if the tension is negative, so positive tension, when you have a string, it tries to actually come back to being straight. Negative tension, it's trying to elongate. And when you have negative tension, then this actually can fill the heart and provide another mechanism for fibrillation. And the other important property that I just showed you is the fact that the spiral can rotate along the filament, and this is twist. And actually, Art Winfrey was one of the did pioneering simulations that show that when vortex filament is twisted beyond a threshold twist, then the filament will actually sprawl or change conformation, go into a helix. Very much like a telephone cord, if you twist it, you've all experienced that, at least, well, now you have portables, but for the old telephone. So now, with this movie, I would like to illustrate actually one of the frontier of the field in terms of understanding mechanisms of fibrillation. Even with the most sophisticated techniques, so far what has been imaged very accurately is with high resolution is only the electrical activity on one surface of the heart. So, and there's been progress in trying to image those vortex filaments, and Arkady Pertsov has spearheaded a lot of this work. But despite a lot of efforts, we still don't have the type of resolution of the electrical activity of the heart to really observe these strings and to look at their dynamics. So what's interesting is when you look at this region here of cardiac tissue, what you're seeing is actually a very turbulent and disorganized activity. You see some spirals here on the surface, just like I showed you in the movie of the Cornell group. But then you also see this breakthrough of activations, right? So there are some activation that you see on this surface that you cannot just explain unless you really understand this more organized activity in the thickness of the muscle. And certainly one of the frontier is experimentally to be able to image this electrical activity of the heart in three dimension in order to actually test different theories. So this the problem is not one of energy scale here, but it's a problem of three dimension. Where modeling is also going is that there is databases now. They've been careful serial sectioning of the heart that gives you an entire geometry of the heart and a whole set of fiber patterns. And now it is possible to actually do computer simulation in a realistic heart geometry. This is work that is being done by Flavio Fenton, my former student who is now at Cornell. And so people are able to simulate this electrical activity in realistic heart geometry and to test some of these mechanisms. So now we're all sitting here. You say, well, this is all nice. This fibrillation, we understand the mechanism. What does that do for us? So how do we tame cardiac fibrillation? So current successes and failures. So current failure is drug therapy. So if you think at the molecular level, you can add drugs that can modify the electrical properties of all these molecular switches. And you know they are very selective. So you can decide to either enhance the properties of these channels or actually block them. But to know which channel to pick, you need to have some theory. You need to have some understanding of what's the mechanism. So I explained to you earlier that lethal triggers are not good, right? Premature ventricular contractions can be causes of initiation for tachycardia and fibrillation. So one of the hypotheses was to add a sodium channel blocker, and this was actually the hypothesis that underlined the cardiac arrhythmia suppression trial, the CAS trial. And this trial was interrupted because the group with placebo had a higher survival rate than the people who were given the drugs. Another hypothesis that you can do, if you remember this sort of reentrant or anatomical reentry where you have a wave which is going around an obstacle, is a class 3 drug where you actually now act on the potassium channel to prolong the duration of the wave. And if the wavelength is large enough and it cannot fit in the circuit, then you don't have tachycardia. That also turned out to be very disappointing. So the most reliable, but the success is the implantable cardioverter defibrillator, where you have two shocking pads that are put on the heart. This continuously records the electrical activity of the heart, and if it detects an abnormal signals, it will first try to pace the heart out of fibrillation, and then if that fails, it will charge a capacitor and then delivers a large electrical shock to the heart. So it's basically walking around with a defibrillator. With no surprise, some of our elected officials, for better or for worse, have opted for this option. So, you know, typical. So I've been told that actually the defibrillator has never gone off in our dear vice president, for better or for worse. And so what I will show you here is actually a movie showing defibrillation working in the human heart from a transplant patient. So this is a spare part. And no, this should come later. Okay. Oh, it's not showing. All right, let's see. You think it will? Oh, there it goes. So here you're looking in the left ventricles of this heart. This is a movie from Medtronic, which is one of the device maker. And actually, the heart here is fibrillating. I'm seeing more of it here on my screen. But anyway, you can see that actually the muscle is twitching and it's fibrillating. And now it's been electrical shock has been given. It's now back to normal rhythm. Okay. Let's see here. Okay, back to business. All right, so you know, the implantable cardioverter defibrillator has certainly been successful, but it's very costly and also cannot be implanted in all patients. And so what is the outlook for actually doing better than just a massive shock? Can we use this understanding? So one certainly promising avenue is, I've shown you that the dynamic heterogeneities that induce static cardiac fibrillation can originate from dynamical instability at the cellular level. We talked about these alternants. So flattening restitution was certainly one possibility, and we saw that at least in one animal experiment that could prevent fibrillation. But in biology, things are never as simple as you would first expect it. So actually, it's been appreciated more recently that actually this period doubling oscillation can be caused by an instability of the calcium signal, which then actually causes a period doubling oscillation of the voltage signal. And to make things simple, as now people are looking actually at this period doubling oscillation on a cellular scale, so now you're seeing here a single cardiac cell, and you're imaging the calcium activity in this cell, and now you're seeing these cordon alternates that I showed you earlier, but inside a single cell. So this oscillation can become desynchronous at the level of a single cell. So to be able to really come up with effective drug therapies to suppress these type of instabilities which promote fibrillation, we need to have a deeper understanding of this instability at the single cell level. This is actually a movie from Jim Weiss showing how dynamic this calcium activity can be at a single cell level. My cursor can come back. Oops, let's see, where is it? There it goes. So here what's being imaged is in the single cardiac myocytes. This is the calcium activity which is being shown here. They are actually alternants, or they are these period doubling oscillations of the calcium signal. And what is being shown here, actually the phase of these oscillations. So shown in red are regions which are actually have a large contraction, a small contraction, or large calcium transient small. And the blue actually have the opposite phase, small and large. And this white region is this nodal region. So you can see that these, the synchronization, the dynamics of these oscillations already at the level of in single cell are quite complex. So really there is a need for understanding and being able to bridge length scale from a single cell to the whole tissue. And let me just skip this. Very beautiful results were presented at this workshop by Andy Wasserstrom, and I don't want to offend any of the other speakers by saying this was one of the most exciting presentation, but this is the first time that it's a real tour de force. So what has been done is this experiment is in an intact heart to actually, during the normal function of an intact heart, to actually image the calcium activity at the level of a single cell and of a small patch of tissue. Okay, and what you see here actually is this calcium alternance and actually this desynchronization in these complex patterns of calcium activity. So certainly these new techniques are going to be very important in trying to identify pharmacological targets that allow to do some intervention at the cellular level, which can then prevent the genesis of arrhythmias at the organ level. Another very promising avenue is to actually find a way of lowering the threshold of defibrillation. So one of the main problems with implantable cardioverter defibrillator is that the energy of the shock on the order of 10 to 30 joules is so large and it's very painful for the patient and very traumatic. So is there a way that one can use the insights from theoretical insights, from knowledge of spiral waves and so on, to find some ways of actually using low voltage stimuli which are not imperceptible to the patient? So here is some ideas in this direction, some collaboration, some ideas of Valentin Krinsky in collaboration with the Cornell group. So the idea goes as follows. What actually a main defibrillation shock does, the large shock that you get from the current devices, is to actually depolarize the whole heart so all the spiral waves are extinguished because all the waves collide and there is no more reentrant activity than you hope, then the normal sinus waves take over. So the idea here is the following. If you have a defibrillating shock, usually the electric field, the transmembrane potential, it doesn't penetrate because there is actually because of the resistive property of cardiac tissue, the transmembrane potential, the perturbation of transmembrane potential only penetrates on the order of a millimeter in the heart. However, if there are obstacles, if there are little clefts or small infarcts or small heterogeneities in the heart, then actually these heterogeneities can actually act as pacemakers, because in the presence of an external electric field, heterogeneities act as pacemaker, because one side of heterogeneity hyperpolarizes and the other one depolarizes and can give rise as a source of trigger. So the idea that came out of this concept is, instead of sending a large shock, is to use the same type of electrode that gives a massive differential shock, but to give a high frequency perturbation. So this was actually tested experimentally, and what is shown here is this idea of using the same electrodes that give the massive defibrillatory shock, but instead of using a massive defibrillatory shock, to give a sequence of pulses at lower amplitude. So here is what's happening. In this region here, in this window, this is in a dog, which is in an episode of ventricular fibrillation, and what you see is that there is already this reentrant activity with these spiral waves that I've been showing you, and there is this complex pattern. Here, this low voltage stimulus is being given, and what you see now is that this region here actually depolarizes and then sends a wave. You get a sequence of activation, and this is now further in this sequence of activation. Now this is depolarizing. You see that the reentry has been extinguished, the waves are propagating, and then finally at the end, then there's been termination of this episode of ventricular fibrillation by utilizing the fact that the heart has heterogeneities, and that these heterogeneities can act as pacemaker in the presence of much lower applied electric field. So it's using really the physics of the of these what are called virtual electrodes. One thing that one can be concerned is that, as I showed you also earlier in the talk, having this little pacemaker is also can be a source of an arrhythmia mechanism. So the question is, will it be proarrhythmic or not? In a real implantation is certainly something that remains to be seen. But Valentin's hypothesis is this should be used, and if it fails anyway, then the main defibrillatory shock will be successful. Okay, so I think I will stop here. I think I hope I've given you some flavor for all the exciting developments and possibilities people are working on to try to tame cardiac fibrillation. Some acknowledgments. This was my first student that worked with me and did a lot of nice work. That is now with the Cornell Group. Blasi Chebaria is a postdoc in Barcelona. Mary Watnabi, now at St. Louis University. Johannes Schifero is now a postdoc at UCLA. Daisuke Sato is just finishing his thesis going to UCLA. This is an undergraduate who is now at Princeton, Luke McDonald. These are my UCLA collaborators and the support of AHA and NIH. A few faces. This is Flavio Fenton. This is the one who was holding the heart. This is Luke McDonald, actually, that did his co-op, Northeastern has a co-op program at Mass General working in radiation therapy. So this was, he was in the co-op program. This is Blas Echebarria, who is just getting married July 29. This is Mary Watnabi, who is a wonderful person. This is Johannes Schifero and Daisuke Sato, I know, but they also smile sometimes, so these pictures are not representative. And then special thanks to my wife for all her support. She's actually in Argentina with my two kids, Gabriel and Danielle. So I'll just conclude there.
Well, thank you very much. That was absolutely fascinating. And I'm sure, as usual, there are many questions. So, but please don't talk till I give you the microphone.
Can you discuss or say something about actual real sudden death and how that could come about, and possibly someone who has no prior history of heart disease?
So you know, fortunately, you know, when one gives this public lecture as a physicist, when the questions come real cardiology, sometimes difficult for the physicist to answer the question. So fortunately, we have some of the leading cardiologists here, and I've, you know, I told them that when I will need to deflect the questions, I will. But let me first try to first understand a little bit more your question. So, are you asking what frequency of the what percentage of the people who die of sudden death have no prior history of heart disease? I'm trying to understand.
Yeah. Those patients, yeah. Who would be like that, would drop dead.
Right. So for people that, you know, usually drop dead, in a majority of cases, the triggering event is a, you know, piece of plaque that detaches and blocks one of the coronary artery and causes an infarct. Okay. In many cases, nowadays, there's, you know, very early intervention, so people survive a heart attack. So this whole population are at risk of, you know, sudden cardiac death. The majority of cases are already people who have heart disease from a prior myocardial infarction or from, you know, cardiac hypertrophy or various heart disease that causes, you know, an abnormal substrate. So certainly the, you know, the type of pharmacological intervention or the, you know, the, that you want to target will depend on the nature of the cardiac disease. And I think Jim Weiss can comment.
Jim, why don't you come up here? There might be some more questions then.
So Jim is head of clinical cardiology at UCLA, and we've been collaborating, and I think he's better qualified than I am to answer the clinical questions.
Thank you. Well, it's interesting, you know, one of the huge problems in cardiology is identifying the patients who are at really high risk for sudden cardiac death. And as Alan mentioned, the only really effective therapy we have right now is a defibrillator. But the statistics are that most of the patients who die of sudden cardiac death don't meet the criteria for putting in a defibrillator, in the sense that even though people who meet those criteria might have a pretty high risk of sudden death, let's say 20% or something like that, the total number of those patients is very small compared to the millions of people who don't meet those criteria who have, may have a much lower risk of sudden death. So even if their risk is 1%, just because there's so many of them, about 70 or 80% of the patients who will ultimately die suddenly, a clinical cardiologist would have no reason to put a defibrillator in. So the problem right now is, how do you identify those patients who are at high enough risk to be able to tell? And that's one of the real burning questions. And, you know, there's a lot of work being done in that area, and there's a lot of interest, for example, in identifying genetic markers that might put people at risk, and you know, a whole variety of different approaches trying to solve this issue.
And T-wave alternates being an example of marker. Yeah.
In some of your movies,
yeah,
where you showed this rotating wave,
mm-hmm,
and a plot was made of the origin, I will call it, and it seemed to show a chaotic path around,
right,
an attractor.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, most cases, it seemed a single attractor, but I saw one briefly that looked like regular multiple attractors. Is that a spatial or a time? I don't understand exactly what that movement is.
Right, okay, so let me go back to... That's a question I can answer. Oops, let me just go back to look at the movie so I can comment. So, taking some time to load, but basically, the spiral can have different dynamical modes of propagation, and the simplest is where it's just rigid rotation, where the spiral just rotates around an excitable core. But you can think that there's an interaction between the wave front and actually the tail of the wave, which is leaving refractory tissue, right? So in a sense, the spiral is a wave that bites its own tail. And when the front tail interaction becomes large or sufficiently strong, then this rigid rotation is destabilized, becomes unstable. And then there's actually a second frequency of motion, and the second frequency of motion give rise to this flower pattern. So it's still the primary frequency of rotation plus a second frequency which comes from the front tail interaction. And so it's an intrinsic instability and mode of the spiral. And whether you have rigid rotation or this meandering, you know, sort of petal, flower petal-like trajectories depends on the parameters and the properties of the tissue.
This is a question which is probably for Dr. Weiss. However, the question is roughly how many individuals in the United States actually have defibrillators installed, and do they typically use the same technology?
I don't know. I recall the exact number. I don't know. Is Bill Stevenson here or David? But the technology, you know, like most things in medicine, advances with time, and so they're getting better and better. But basically, it's pretty much, you know, trying to swat a fly with a sledgehammer. It's a very crude approach, and that's one of the reasons why we're really trying to find more subtle ways of doing it. It is painful, for example, if you're awake when you have one of these shocks, and there are complications of pacemakers. So we think there are much more elegant ways to do this, but right now, it's really the only, you know, proven effective therapy. The other thing I would mention is that, as a cardiologist, as Alan said, most of these episodes actually occur in the setting of an acute myocardial infarction. So take your aspirin, stop smoking, watch the fat, exercise regularly, and all of those things.
Actually, I have a question. Which was something that confused me a bit, because most of your talk in describing the onset of, of these waves that give rise to defibrillation were caused by macroscopic scale events or obstacles or even dynamics. And then at the end you started discussing patterns that arose at the molecular level, or at the cellular level. So that's quite a stretch, right? I mean,
right,
at the beginning you were discussing things that were...
Right, so, okay, so let me, I think that's a question I can answer. So if you think of the alternance, which this discordant alternance that was shown at the scale of the whole heart, where you had two regions that oscillated out of phase. So this is, you know, this is a macroscopic level observation. It provides a substrate for reentry on that scale. But now, let's say that your goal becomes, you know, how can I find pharmacological targets, you know, designing anti-arrhythmic drugs with the goal of suppressing these alternates, right? So, you know, all these billions of cells are electrically coupled, but the mechanism of the alternates, actually, as we understand it, is on the cellular scale. So you can dissociate all the cells in the heart, look and paste an individual cell, and you will see that this individual cell will have these alternates. Then you say, okay, fine, so that's at the level of one cell, and then you say, well, let me look inside that cell to maybe try to understand better. And then once you look at that scale, you see that actually even the activity on the cellular scale is not synchronized, is more complex. So then it's, you know, it's bringing you down to shorter and shorter scale to try to answer that question. The other thing that should be said also is where the cellular scale phenomena are important is in the triggers. So I showed that these lethal triggers, these premature ventricular contraction, can be quite arrhythmogenic. But, you know, so these originate from a small localized region of the heart. However, they come from abnormalities at the cellular level. In fact, abnormality of the release of calcium can give rise to this premature trigger. But again, there's a problem of synchronization because you need a sufficiently large number of cells to synchronously give rise to this spontaneous release of calcium, which can then downstream trigger a wave. So I think, you know, there is a very complex interaction between what's happening at the level of a single cell, synchronization at the level of, you know, several cells, and finally at the level of the heart. I hope I...
In development.
It's still, yeah, very much so.
Yes, sir. Are the same physical, are the physics issues and the biochemical issues the same in arterial fibrillation as in ventricular?
Okay, so that's a very good question. So atrial fibrillation is actually a larger problem than ventricular fibrillation. I think the numbers is, what, 5 million or 15 million? What's the... Right, so atrial fibrillation is certainly a major problem. But atrial fibrillation does not, that's the question I can answer. Okay, then we can have Jim. Right. So atrial fibrillation does not, you know, you don't die of sudden death because the main pump of the heart are the ventricles. So even if you have this turbulent electrical activity in the atria, the ventricles are still pumping blood. The issue becomes that this irregular activity in the atria cause an irregular blood flow, which tends to promote formation of clots, right? Which can then increase the risk of stroke. So the way that atrial fibrillation is being I think the common therapy is to actually just give blood thinning drugs, which then prevent the clots from forming. But then the dosage of this drug has to be very monitored very carefully, because if you look at the probability of forming a clot as you add blood thinning drug, it first goes down, right? So this is good. But then if you add too much blood thinning drug, then the probability of getting cerebral hemorrhage goes up. So it's a very careful dosage where actually you prevent the formation of clots, but you don't promote cerebral hemorrhage. So but I think with the my understanding is that with the right dosage of this blood thinning drug, the prognosis for life expectancy of somebody with atrial fibrillation is very comparable to someone without atrial fibrillation. Is that?
I'm giving you an honorary stethoscope. That was
I think everyone is after that prognosis. Seems relieved. So let's, after we thank the speaker again, there are, as usual, refreshments in the common room, which you're all invited to join us. And let's thank Ellen again for a wonderful talk.
Yeah, we're good. Okay, good.